Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else fill the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, friends, family, and strangers. This is another episode of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake McClure this week. Jeff McClure is still recovering, so we'll be looking forward to him coming back. I have to start with a disclosure. The Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of an investment advisory firm registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission out of Salado, Texas. And not coincidentally, the principals of that firm are generally the same people that are the hosts of this show. What does that mean? It means that if you're an investment advisory firm, or if anyone is an investment advisory firm, they have signed off on being fiduciaries. I don't give fiduciary advice on the air. I don't give specific advice on the air. So those are interesting pieces. When I talk about the economy, or when I give educational references on how to invest, it's not the same ball game. I can't really give advice to people unless I know them really well, because everybody's different. I can give you the rules to start with. I can give you the game plan to begin. But if you really need help, you need to go to a fiduciary individually. Okay, and that means that if you're getting all your investment advice on the radio, you're probably not getting the best advice. So get it individualized. When it comes to what I'm going to be talking about, most of what I talk about on the air here is very broad, talking about economic policies of different countries and different companies and how revenue is paid to the government and things like that. Also, where we're going as an economy, because all of that needs to be known by you in order to make investment decisions, but also to know if people are telling you the truth in any realm. So let me start by, as we usually do, talking about the what the S&P 500 did this week. The S&P 500 is an index, and yes, there are funds that can invest directly, what it seems like, directly into that index. The reality is that they try to mirror the index. They try to match it. They're not really investing directly in it, and that's kind of a technicality, but it's a very real one in that when the S&P 500 decides that they need to remove one company and put in another, there are no trading costs. And the losses associated with the sale of a company that is leaving because it was getting smaller and the bringing on of a company that's getting bigger, that isn't seen in the index, but it is seen in the funds that are trying to mirror the index. So that's something, it's a caveat in there, it's an important one to know. It's almost impossible for the S&P 500 index fund to exactly match the index. And I know that's getting into a weird area, but people think if I've got it in the index, then it's following it exactly. And that's not always the case, and there have been some problems with that in the past. Okay, so what did it do this week? Well, for most of the week, it was just fine. It did what it's been doing for several months, which is just not much. It's been kind of just flat, a little bit up, a little bit down. It's a little bit strange in my perspective, because in the middle of a big political season, in the middle of bad news and good news coming in great quantities of scares that in the past would have caused massive changes in the market, nothing has happened until Friday. Yesterday, we had a big downturn in the market, a single-day decline in the S&P 500 that had the whole week down by about 2.4%. So it ended the week at 2,127.81, as if anybody cares what the last decimal place was there. It makes me sound very intelligent to go 2,127.81. This is kind of a normal change from a calm to a more volatile time period. What we're talking about in the market, I've been kind of surprised. I mentioned this just a minute ago. I've been surprised that during this whole summer, we've had so little volatility. We've had massive news out about Trump, massive news out about Hillary Clinton. And it seems like every day there's a new set of massive news, whatever it is. We've heard jobs reports. We've had the Federal Reserve saying they're going to raise interest rates. We've had the market saying, I don't think that they're really going to do it. Or lots of people in the market. And eventually, people are looking around and saying, okay, it's a tight race. We don't know what's going to happen. And by the way, this is just a side note. The thing that investors hate the most, people like to say the market hates the most, but I people think when I'm talking about the market that I'm talking about this, envision some air quotes here, Wall Street. Wall Street is a very small place in Manhattan. Wall Street is really you. If you're listening to this program, you're most likely invested in something in the market, which means you're Wall Street. So let's erase that kind of misconception that somehow Wall Street's making decisions. It's you and people like you all over the country. And generally speaking, the thing that we hate the worst as investors is uncertainty. So when things start to look a little bit more certain, even if it's a bad thing that we're certain about, we get to be more calm because we can start making decisions based on that certainty. When things begin to be uncertain, then we have volatility in the market. Well, we don't know. And you can go back to 2000, the year 2000, and think about the dot-com bubble. Well, Arthur Andersen, Enron time frame, all those big scandals hit. The reason why the market tanked at that point was because we weren't certain what the profits were anywhere. Because if accounting firms could lie, then we don't know what is true. Okay, now we come forward to 2007, 2008. The reason why the market tanked and the economy tanked is because we weren't certain who was lying on their mortgages, what banks were lying in accepting mortgages, who owned the debt that was being paid, and how it could be foreclosed on if it wasn't being paid. So uncertainty is the enemy of good investing. And as long as one candidate or the other in the presidential election is ahead by enough that people go, okay, that's a good lead, it doesn't matter which candidate. This is one of those things. People get up in arms about this. Oh, you just think Hillary or you just think Trump. It's not that. We hate uncertainty. If Trump is going to be elected, and we have a pretty good idea he is, or Hillary Clinton is going to be elected, and we have a pretty good idea she is, then we can begin to formulate plans around the things that they've stated and give probabilities to whether or not their promises are actually going to be fulfilled. And most of both of their promises are not likely to be fulfilled, which is an easy thing to cancel out some of the uncertainty. But that's not the way we feel about it. So the market has been relatively flat for months, not doing anything, very calm. Not calm in a sense of I'm not afraid, but calm in a sense of the mouse hiding in the corner when the cat's walking by. We don't know which way things are going to go. Well, the polls are becoming even again. Trump and Clinton are neck and neck. Clinton's just a little bit ahead. Trump's just a little bit ahead. Clinton's been more ahead than Trump. Okay, that creates uncertainty. Throw on the fact that there's this internal debate going on by these big hedge fund managers and economists that are doubting what the Federal Reserve has said publicly. Oh, they're not really meaning it. They're not really going to raise interest rates. The markets hear these economists say that and they go, oh, well, then I can just keep on going like I am. Yesterday, we had a little bit of a moment where we realized that the Federal Reserve is probably going to raise interest rates. Now, it's what they said a week and a half ago. They said they would. But we're coming to that point where we go, oh, the bad news hasn't been bad enough because the quote, and these air quotes again, and if you can follow along, you listeners, throw the air quotes in the air for me because you can't see my own. The jobs report came out last week and people were upset about it. It was very negative. It was not very negative. It was lukewarm at best or at worst. It was more jobs created than lost by a large amount, and more than enough to make up for new people coming into the market. That, in any other time in the last 7 years or so, would have been blazingly good news. But we were using it as bad news, or we being the generalized American public, we're hearing it as bad news because we expected a slightly higher number. Well, from the Federal Reserve's perspective, first, what are their job? They're trying to make sure we don't have inflation. I think we can all agree we don't want inflation. When things get more expensive and they're not worth anymore. And a lot of the listeners here experienced a lot of inflation at a time. I've talked to people semi-regularly that discuss Jimmy Carter and how much they don't like him and still don't like him because of the inflation during the time he was in office, that their dollar became worthless. Inflation is a big enemy. Getting ahead of it is the Federal Reserve's job, and they're seeing growth in the economy. And I realize right now you're hearing from both candidates that the things are broken and they want to fix them. The reality is that the economy is in good shape. It's geared up, and it's beginning to pull forward a little bit faster than even I was expecting. I expect even further next year, as long as no major tax laws are changed, no major anything has changed on either side, that we're going to have a boom that is pretty tremendous, because I'm seeing all the signs for it now, and it has nothing to do with who gets elected. Keep that in mind. That's smoke and mirrors. When people say, I'm going to bring jobs, and they're both claiming that right now, the major candidates are talking about it. The way that the president can make jobs is, one, he can create an organization in the government that's hiring people. That doesn't create growth in the economy. It may move money around a little bit, but it's a net zero, and that all those jobs are being paid for by the rest of us because it's our taxpayer money that's doing it. There's no additional money coming into the system. It's net zero. The pie is the size it is, and you can't make it any bigger doing that. The other side they can do doesn't create jobs at all. It actually removes jobs from people in other countries, which is to put up trade blocks, and both candidates are talking about that right now as well. Hillary Clinton is doing it because Bernie Sanders is supporting her now, and if Bernie Sanders is supporting her now, then she can't support free trade type agreements that she's been behind for a long time. Trump has never been behind the free trade agreements. So the concept that we can somehow create jobs in the United States by charging people in other countries more money to bring their goods here, it's been disproven so many times in history. It's just completely surprising to me that we can still say that it might work, that creating a tariff on Chinese goods or Mexican goods will somehow bring the jobs back to the United States. That's never worked in any country in the history of the world. It does make people feel good for a little bit until their prices go up and the jobs don't come back. And then they just have higher prices and no jobs. This is not a good thing. In fact, part of the reason why we entered into the Great Depression was because of the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which was exactly the same concept as lowering the ability to trade with the rest of the world, increasing the cost of other countries bringing goods here. That caused us to tank into a depression that didn't bring jobs back and made the jobs that we had, a lot of them, go away. So the idea here, and this is a great time to segue into this, Trump is a big proponent of tariffs on Chinese goods and large tariffs on Mexican goods. Well, Mexico is, at any given time, either our number one or number two largest trading partner. They flip back and forth with Canada. I know Canada and Mexico are not spoken about a lot as our largest trading partner. We talk about China or Germany, but they are the ones that we trade the most with by large, large margins. If we're to slap a tariff, on goods coming from Mexico, that will cause the prices of our automobiles to come up because a lot of the parts are made there. It will cause the prices of print books to go up because that's where a lot of those print books are made. will it cause us to start manufacturing car parts again in the United States? Maybe. It's a strong possibility. Will it cause us to hire a bunch of people to do it? No. We'll figure out a technological solution so that we can keep the prices down. And that's something that has happened every time this has come up. If we bring those parts back here, we're going to have to re-gear. We're going to have to change the way that we are creating our automobiles. And if we do that at a point where robots are as inexpensive as they are, and we have to do it because the price just went up on the labor overseas or down south, then the end result is that prices stay the same, or they get higher for a little bit, and then they come slowly back down. But no new jobs are created in the United States, or very few. Net negative jobs. Because while the automobile manufacturers will bring a few jobs back in to run those robots, and robots are what we're talking about today, but if you go back even to the mid-1800s, when the jobs were being sent to from North United States to South United States as the steam engines were coming on, and the North was saying, hey, we need to tax the Southern goods as they come back up. Yes, that was a real conversation. It's part of the things that led to the Civil War, was this kind of conversation. The North was losing jobs to the South, and the South was upset because they'd just been through a massive depression that the North had missed. Every time we export jobs, it's because we're in a competitive environment. If we want to sell goods to the United States, we're consumers, or to the rest of the world, we have to compete on price. If our labor prices are too high, like they got in the 70s, when the unions didn't have any competition, when the big three automakers were the big three automakers of the world, not just the United States, when they had no competition because everybody that might compete against them were still recovering from being bombed into the Stone Age in World War II. They could set the price. And as long as they could set the price, the unions then had a lot of clout. They could say to the management, hey, you guys can set the price, so we need more. And the management says, well, we have to balance that against shareholder wishes. And then the end result of it is that the negotiating table's pretty small, because there's not a lot of competition in the rest of the world. And if all three of the big automakers are negotiating with the same union, prices are going to go up. Well, that allowed the rest of the world to compete with us with one arm tied behind their back. Because, and it ended in the last recession, the Great Recession, where General Motors went bankrupt and Chrysler was purchased by an Italian company. The idea that we can set a contract in the 1970s to have incremental job increases regardless of whether or not they're creating better products, that's the notion that is implicit in inflation. Well, that's when those contracts were written. If we put a tariff on other people's goods and on Chinese goods, it will cause all of your electronics, everything that you have that you didn't have 10 years ago, items like computers, televisions that are flat screen, better headphones, better speakers, better iPads, iPhones, smartphones. You go through the list of things that are made in China, and there's a joke that I heard the other day that we found where God is, because God made everything and everything's made in China. If we put a tariff on them, the reality is that American workers are not going to make inexpensive little gewgaws to sell. We are better educated than that. The fact is that we're close to full employment. It wasn't the case a year and a half ago. A year and a half ago, there were still a lot of people that had been out of work for a long time. There's still people that have been out of work for a long time, but they're a very, very tiny minority. And when compared to that same group of people in 2006, right before the Great Recession, we're back at about the same percentage of the population. So as far as the jobs go, we've recovered, plus the population growth, we're at a good state. Now, there's other unemployment figures to talk about. There's the U6, the people that are looking for are no longer looking for jobs. They're discouraged. They don't want a job anymore. Well, that's including a lot of people that have retired as well. The baby boomer generation has retired or is beginning to retire in larger and larger numbers. As they do that, the U6 figure is going to stay pretty flat, even when we hire more people, because people are leaving the workforce and they're not even bothering to look for new jobs. It sounds like that's a horrible thing. Oh, you lazy, incompetent people, not even bothering. Well, they're retired. They're driving around in RVs and going to national parks. This is a good thing. Where we are as far as jobs go, and I know that's one of the big debates going on in politics. It makes me laugh because jobs are important, but the president doesn't have the ability to create jobs, and we're already very close to full employment. If you get into full employment and beyond, then inflation is a really big danger. Kind of getting esoteric here. The idea behind trade, and I'm going to make this segue, I said I would. Robert Reich, who was the Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, is a big proponent of saying that free trade is not good for the United States. So he's about as liberal as you can get in the old world. And we have Donald Trump, the conservative candidate, saying exactly the same thing. If you go back to Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, they all agreed that free trade was good for the economy, very good for the economy. They had, maybe it's an arrogance to say that American workmanship is going to be able to compete with anybody in the world, so come and get it. But it's a true arrogance. Our workmanship is better than everybody else in the world. Our proficiency in creating things, our productivity is higher than anywhere else in the developed world. We have the ability to compete with anybody on that subject. As long as it's a new item that our expertise is able to work, you know, and that's basically the biggest piece of it, that our expertise is able to shine. If it's an item that we can't improve over a machine moving around some parts and putting them together, we don't need to take our highly trained brains in the United States, and we've got some really amazingly highly trained brains here, and make them do what a machine can do, or what somebody who has absolutely no education and just needs to know how to put this gear on top of that gear, or how to screw in one screw into one hole, or two screws in the back of an iPhone case. That sort of thing is not the kind of jobs we want to come back. And those are the jobs that we've exported. We're not exporting our high-brow programming jobs very much. India is getting some of them. Russia is getting some of them. China is getting some of them. Most of those jobs that are going over there are the ones that we don't want. Now, long-term, that could have an implication. But throwing a tariff on the goods that are coming back doesn't put any negativity, any downturn in the trade for programming stuff. That's a service. I've got a caller on 773-1400. Just a minute. Let me turn on the telephone here. All right. Caller, you are on the air. Could you turn down your radio, please?
Got it.
All right. Caller, go ahead.
Enjoy the show. Enjoy the newsletter. You know, the last couple of years, the talking heads have said that lots of primarily American corporations operating overseas are sitting on, you know, hundreds, if not, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars in cash. Now, I'm sure that's not in the passbook account. What instruments, where do they have that money parked, and what would be the effect of those instruments if they repatriated that money? I'll hang up on this.
All right, good question. Thank you, caller. There is an absolutely astronomical amount of money owned by American companies that are sitting in bank accounts in places overseas because it would cost too much to bring it back. Our taxes are not geared the way the rest of the world's taxes are. In effect, We already have a tariff on American money coming back to American soil. One of the things that I like about Donald Trump's tax plan is he has a one-time repatriation of that money at a 10% tax. Now, that doesn't create a long-term benefit because they'll just slowly build up more. This is more like what Ronald Reagan did with illegal immigration. It's a temporary fix. There needs to be a permanent fix. What would happen if Apple and Google could bring back the money that they've got sitting overseas? Well, Apple and Google and all the other big, General Motors is one of them. General Electric is another. There's huge companies, the global companies, the ones that everybody would recognize the names. Most of them have money parked overseas. Where'd that money come from? That money was earned overseas for the sale of American goods. So we sold stuff over there. We paid the taxes on that money over there in France, in Germany, or in, you know, what Apple's talking about is they're doing it in Ireland. The European Union's upset because they used Ireland. Well, they're based in Ireland and have been since the 1980s. Their European operations are based there. Well, the European Union doesn't like it because Ireland has one of the lowest corporate income tax rates. So the European Union says, wait, you sold the goods in Germany from Ireland, therefore you owe us taxes. So there's this big $14.1 billion tax debt that Apple is fighting the European Union on. There's a little piece, a side note here. Ireland is also fighting the European Union on the same subject. Where does that $14.1 billion go if it were to come as a tax? It would go to Ireland. Ireland is fighting against accepting $14.1 billion. Think about that for a minute. The reason why they're fighting against it is because they like having a corporate haven where people can be innovative and keep what they make. In the United States, if you make money in Germany and you bring it back, even if you're a citizen, just not even like you're not a big corporation, you're a citizen. Well, the first about, and it changes every year, but the first about $100,000 that you make over there gets to be taxed over there, and we won't tax it. The United States says, hey, you already paid taxes on it. That's fine. If you make more than that, every dollar that you make more than that gets taxed both places. You get taxed over there and over here. That doesn't sound very nice. Okay, more than $100,000, those must be really wealthy people. Not really, because if you're a couple and you're two people making money overseas, and you bring it, and you're an American, then you're getting taxed twice. That makes it really hard to do business overseas. Well, why are they over there anyway? Why don't they come back? Well, since when have we said it's not a good idea to travel? It's one of the big things about America is we believe that you have the right to go wherever you want without the Gestapo asking for your papers. That's the rest of the world that does that. So what would happen? What would be the benefit if somehow we had the tax law change so that corporate money made overseas or any money made overseas that was already taxed overseas could come back to the United States without additional taxes paid on it or with just a little amount of taxes paid on it? Well, number one, a lot of money would come back. A lot of money would come back because the reality of the world is that the greatest innovation that takes place anywhere in the world is in the United States, and the best bang for the buck that you can get with that for innovation, with that money for innovation, is going to take place in the United States. You can hire people with greater brain power, and I can get to that in a minute. You can get to people that have more creativity, more ability to create patents, more ability to push a business productivity or profit margins up. And that's based right here. Our system of taxation right now is so absolutely confoundingly convoluted that it takes huge amounts of money just to figure out how much you owe, and it may not be right at a corporate level. And if you have at least some basis for saying this is why you filed it, it's like I've mentioned this in the past. It's like the ancient priesthood They come and sprinkle chicken blood on the ground to figure out which direction the rain's going to come from, and then you have to pay them money. Well, the IRS does that. Even when they give you tax advice, they tell you that the tax advice isn't worth anything. If you listen to the tax line at the IRS, and the recording that plays all the time, is anything that you hear from us is probably not something you can use. That's not cool. If we could bring back all that money, it would create jobs. That absolutely would. It wouldn't be the president creating jobs. It would be the companies here being able to hire more people to do the things that they want to do. So we already have a tariff. It's right now it's tariff on American money coming back to American soil, American companies' money. And that's just a tax. But if you think about it, we have that those taxes on American companies within the United States as well. And I've got another caller, so I'm going to put this question on hold for a minute. Caller on 773-1400. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is the first time I've called in.
Well, welcome.
My wife is getting ready. She's 59 and a half, but she wants to take money out of her thrifty savings plan.
Her what savings plan?
It's called a thrifty savings. She works for she works for the government.
Okay, TSP, a thrift. Thrift. Yes. There's no Y on it. Thrift savings plan. Okay. It's okay.
I'm 75. So I don't know.
Well, congratulations on that, too.
Thank you. My question is, they said that they told her at her place there that they were going to take 20% on tax.
Yep.
Well, that is true.
When you pull money out of a retirement account, and a thrift savings plan is a retirement account, you've never paid taxes on that money. That's one of the benefits of putting the money there is that it goes in pre-tax.
That's right.
When you turn 70 and a half, the U.S. Treasury Department has decreed through the Congress, well, the Congress has decreed that the U.S. Treasury Department, through the IRS, requires you to take money out of there. And they require you to take money out at a kind of extreme rate that will deplete your money before you're dead. So be careful about that and know you can reinvest it in other things. Don't spend it all. That's not what your question is, but that's a really big one. It's called required minimum distributions. Okay, but when you take the money out, part of the reason why they want you to take it out at 70 and a half, and just as a side note, the only people besides the government that puts a half in their name are five-year-olds. So if you're 59 and a half, you can start taking out penalty-free, and 70 and a half, you get to take it out whether you like to or not. The reason why that 20% taxation is on there, and you can request a different withholding rate. You can say, I would rather have it at 10% or at 30%, depending on your tax bracket. But they require you to withhold taxes because you're going to owe taxes on that money when tax time comes. Because it's income. It's if you think of it like the way your paycheck has been given or her paycheck was given to her every month, this portion of the paycheck wasn't ever sent through that tax system. It was just put off to the side in the I'll tax you later category. Well, the IRS wants to get their money. And unfortunately, people tend to spend the money before it's time to pay the taxes on it unless it's a mandatory withholding. So it is true that you're going to have that money held out, and it's generally pretty standard to have a 20% on there. You may wind up getting some money back next year at tax time because you withheld too much, but they are definitely going to take their cut.
Okay. Now, the second part of that was she's wanting to put it into either buying some property or some precious metals or something like that. And because she's not getting anything there at where it is now going in stocks.
Okay.
But, would it be better for her then to borrow, you know, take a loan out then than to pull it out?
No.
Okay.
Let me explain that. I never, ever recommend taking a loan from a major retirement plan. The reason is that all that money in there has not been taxed. So let's think of it. It's a big pool of money that has not been taxed. You get a loan out. It's great. You have money that's come to you from that tax plan, that tax deferral plan, that you haven't paid taxes on. Okay, you get to take that money and turn and spend it on something. Well, before you can liquidate that retirement plan before you can roll it over into another place or treat it like retirement money, you've got to pay that loan back. So where does the money come from to pay that loan? The money comes from money that's already been taxed. So say you pulled out $5,000. You took a loan from the retirement plan for $5,000. That's $5,000 you can spend. It's great. $5,000, you didn't have to pay taxes on it. Well, now you turn around and you want to pay that $5,000 back. Well, where do you get that money? You get that money from money that's already in your bank that you've been getting through your paycheck that you've already paid taxes on. So now you pay taxes on this $5,000 and you put it back in the retirement plan. Later on, when you're retired and you're deciding to take money out of there regularly, you're going to have to pay taxes on it again. Because you paid taxes on the money to pay the loan back, and now you're going to have to pay taxes on the money as you pull it back out. So it's double taxation rather than no taxation until you pull it out. I don't like it. If there's no other alternative, then there are some very, very, very specific reasons why it may be okay. But most cases, it's better to get a credit card and pay the credit card back. Be disciplined about that, though. Now, if she wants to buy precious metals or real estate property, there are a couple of things that I can tell you right now. Precious metals by themselves have no expectation of making a profit. They could make a profit for you. They absolutely could. But if you think about, there's some truisms that you know already. You're 75 years old. You probably know it better than 99% of the listeners. You should never expect to make a profit unless you provide something of greater value than what was before. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So if you show up for work and don't do your job, you're not creating value. You may get a day where you're allowed to do that, or a week if you've been doing it for, you've been working there a long time, but eventually you're not going to have a job anymore because you're not creating value. Therefore, you shouldn't create a profit. There are other ways to make a profit. You can gamble. You can play poker with people. You can go to Vegas and play the slot machines. Now, should you expect to make money doing that? No. You might get lucky, though. Precious metals is a form of speculation. Unless you're a jeweler or someone that makes electronics, you're not adding value to the metal that you're holding. You're waiting for somebody else to come along that wants to pay you more than you paid for it. Now, in the past, even this year, you could make a huge amount of money just owning gold. The problem with it is you never know when that's going to happen. There's no reason for it to happen except that for some reason people want to buy gold. And that could all disappear very, very shortly. If you think about the space exploration missions, and I've talked about this on the program in the past, space exploration missions that are going on right now, quite a few of the companies that are involved in getting up into space aren't doing it to support NASA. They're doing it to mine the asteroids that are floating around out there. And there's a lot of gold, a lot of platinum, a lot of silver, a lot of all kinds of funny-looking metal out there that is very easy to grab. Now, you can on the surface of that say it's really expensive to get up there, it's expensive to move it around. That's what they said to the Spanish about getting to the New World. It's really expensive to get there. It's really expensive to bring anything back of value. We're going to have the technology to do it in the not-too-far-distant future, which means that the prices of precious metals may have a sudden plummet. That's a known danger. We can look at supply and demand and know that there's a massive supply. We had an asteroid a year ago go by, and it wasn't that far out. If we had, if it had been 10 years from now instead of a year ago, we would have had the ability probably to grab it. It had more platinum in the one asteroid than has ever been discovered on the planet of the Earth. So precious metal is a supply-demand. If there's more supply than demand, the price goes down. If there's more demand than supply, the price goes up. If we're looking ahead at a big supply surge, it's a decade out, maybe less. Depends on how much the technology moves forward. Maybe that they're researching that technology in secret. That's pretty normal. So real estate, on the other hand, you have the ability to make some money out of by creating value. If you're managing property that people are renting from you and you keep that property up, you have an income stream and you also have the ability to sell the property at some point, hopefully. It means you have to keep it up and it's an actual job. You either have to hire a management firm or you have to do it yourself. Maybe you can hire somebody else to do it, but the reality is that it's a job. You got to make sure you get your rent on time. You got to make sure that the water heater gets repaired when the tenant wants it repaired. If somebody breaks into the house, you're the one that has to replace the door. So there's work associated with that. Now, on the, you mentioned that her stocks aren't doing well. That would be the first thing to have analyzed for you. If you're going to see, I recommend a fiduciary. Obviously, I recommend somebody that's required to work in your best interest. To look at that and say, why are you not getting a good return there? Because we've had a pretty good return in the market over the last year.
Oh, wow.
So there's something not set up right in her plan if you haven't experienced some of that. It could be that she's just really, really conservative and afraid of the risk, in which case she may not be in the stocks. She may be in something very conservative that hasn't seen any growth. Understanding what's in there is a better idea first. Before you make any moves, understand where you are. And this is the same thing you would tell somebody that's about to go on vacation. If they don't know where they are, trying to decide where they're going is going to be really hard because you don't even know which direction to go. So first, decide where you are. Then decide where you want to go. If your goal is to have an income out of this, then you need to look at the historic places where that income was available. There are places that it's been available. It's been in real estate with rental income. There's some danger associated with that in that you're concentrated in one area. If you are spread out across the country, then you have a lot of money. So diversification goes away, but you have the ability to control those risks by being careful about how you do your management. Some of those risks anyway. When it comes to the stock market, you can control those risks in very similar ways. So being aware of the tools available to you, being aware of how to make the decisions, starts by saying, where am I? Where do I want to go? If you don't have those two things, then you're just looking for good ideas. But if you're looking for good ideas, but you don't know what the end result is, one of the biggest pieces of advice that I can give you is begin with the end in mind. What do you want out of this? But start at the beginning. So you're at the beginning now. You have, or she has, money in the TSP. That money needs to be understood. Where is it? What's it doing and why isn't it performing? Before the decision to try to change what you're doing, because you don't even know what you're doing right now.
That's right.
Okay. So if you need help with that, my staff is going to beat me over the head with this. Give us a call, and I'll give the numbers in, at the end of the hour.
Thank you.
Give us a call, and we'll talk to you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much.
All right.
Okay, we'll follow up. Thank you again.
Thanks for the call.
Let me don't crowd the time.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right, so back to trade. If we bring the money back from overseas, if these American companies bring the money back, that's an immediate large influx of money. What do corporations do with money? Well, they try to make more money with it. They try to make their shareholders happy. In order to do that, they've got to spend money. They've got to spend it in infrastructure, on retraining of existing employees, of new equipment for those employees to use, of hiring people, of getting better at what they do. And so that would cause a big boost to our economy to have that change. The complexity level in the tax system going down would do the same thing. And I, unfortunately or fortunately, have to play some commercials. I've been running my mouth all hour, and I've got a whole bunch of commercials to play. So I'll be back at the end of these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
My dad came to live with us last month, and, you know, it's going pretty well.
I feel like I never...
And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Just a couple of minutes this hour. Let me double say, triple say that the commercials that are played on this program are not approved by us. There was one on there that not only do I not approve, I sincerely disapprove. So there are some dangers and risks associated with that, and I'm not going to go into too much detail because any news is good news when it comes, any publicity is good publicity when it comes to that stuff. All right, so I think I hit the point on bringing the money back in corporate America. That's going to be a big boon. The reality is, though, that we need to do some bigger structural changes to the tax code of the United States and figure out a bigger structural change to how we deal with other countries as far as tax codes go, because that's really the big detriment to business, is that if you're selling something in Texas to somebody in California, you're paying the California sales tax. As long as there's something established in California that you're selling through. So if it's Amazon, if you buy something from Amazon in Texas, you're going to pay Texas sales tax on anything that is sent to you from Texas. Well, that's a lot of record keeping for a company that has people providing products that are being sold all over the world. A lot of record keeping, because every county has a different set of tax codes. Every city. Just think about that for a minute. The complexity is pretty astronomical. We have computers for it, but it's not enough. Removing that complexity, making it simpler, would be a lot better for a business. About out of time, if you'd like to contact us off the air at the Personal Wealth Coach, there's a number to reach locally at 254-947-1111, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. We give advice on portfolios and investing to high net worth people. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email me directly, jake@tpwc.com. You can also email Jeff. He'd probably like to hear from you, jeff@tpwc.com. Until next hour.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.